Hello and welcome to the fifth episode of the Right Minds podcast. It is the 7th of May, 2019. I am your host, Dewey De Boer, and joining me is your regular co-host, Jesse Anderson.
Hello.
He's feeling much better today. We have a special guest with us today as well. His name is Elliot Ikile, and he is the deputy leader of the New Conservative Party.
Pakravatu pomarie korua ko koukru.
Welcome to the show. One of the things that's been hot on the news this week has been the Facebook targeted bans of several popular conservatives, international conservatives, such as Paul Joseph Watson and Milo Yiannopoulos. We've actually set up a new Right Minds group on MeWe, and I know the name sounds a bit strange, but functionally it's about as close and similar to use as Facebook compared to some of the other alternative social medias. Of course, we're on Gab and Minds, but they don't have the same kind of group features that MeWe does, so do join us on there if you're keen. We'll see if shifting away from Facebook is possible. The podcast is also now available on Podbean. So if you are a Podbean user, you can follow the podcast there. And Apple and Google podcasts will be coming soon. You should see all of us here huddled around one microphone. But I think we'll make it work. It was actually donated to us by a listener. And thank you very much to that listener. We're also hoping to get a green screen and some other equipment so that we can actually do some live episodes or record some video segments and get some better audience interaction going. But we'll need a little bit more money for that. And we do actually accept donations. So you can go to rightminds.nz/donate. And all of the details are there. If you'd like to help us out, that would be really awesome. All right, let's get into it. The big news that was announced this morning, like I said, it's a Tuesday, the 7th of May here, and the Justice Minister, he is Justice Minister, isn't he? Andrew Little announced that there will be a cannabis referendum. They will pass some, well, they won't pass, but they will prepare some draft legislation, and the referendum will be a vote, yes or no, based on that legislation. Obviously, having Elliot Ikele here with us is excellent. A coincidence, really, that news came out today, but one of his big talking points has been, should we say, opposition to the legalization of cannabis. So what's your initial thoughts on what's going on here?
With the cannabis push, what we can actually see is, first off, that it's highly exploitative. Basically, they're just trying to push all the potheads out to vote for Labour/Greens, which I think is actually going to be a bit of a problem for one of those parties anyway. The other part of it is that it's just, they are pushing legalization of cannabis at the expense of the majority of New Zealand. Because when we think about smoking weed recreationally, while many people will just be thinking about gathering around with their friends and having a little bit of a session, what you're effectively going to have is the at-risk groups who already suffer by having lots of cannabis and weed lead them to other areas. You are going to have those groups expand numerically, and that will then put more pressure on the police, emergency services, insurance, police, as well as having victims in the innocent communities. So that is what's going to happen, because that is what has happened in areas such as Canada and California and Colorado. The other part of it is the question is not so much about people having little bits of weed to smoke and having a bit of a fun time. What we should actually be looking at is, why are people smoking weed so much in New Zealand? And I would actually say, from my experience as being in youth work for nearly 20 years, is that it is being used as a coping mechanism, as a numbing tool, as a way to flee from life. And if you are bringing legalization of recreational weed into such an environment, that's going to exacerbate problems and antisocial behavior, it will not actually help.
That's a really, really interesting angle as well, in terms of why do people smoke cannabis? Because we can talk all day backwards and forwards about should it be legal, should it not be legal. Clearly, it's not something that's very good for your health. At least I've never seen anyone benefit from it very much. And most people probably know someone who's gone a little bit downhill in terms of drug use.
Well, let me go a bit further, because when I was younger, I got blazed hard. I smoked weed forever. Then I went to Rush and Nos and also even engaged in a bit of heroin when I was younger. Very idiot, but that's what I did. What I have also seen is that some people do use it in a way of helping them get over certain points of trauma in their life. And I mean small points, such as I do know youth workers who will actually smoke a little bit of weed because they are absolutely having ruthless time with young people and they're not able to get proper peer support, peer supervision. So you've got those elements. They know, however, that I love and respect them, but that I will absolutely have no problem if they get snapped and get fined for smoking that weed. That's no worries. I think we do also need to, we do need to look at why, because if we had stronger families in New Zealand, I would be less opposed to it, to the point where I wouldn't even mind it that much, such as the Netherlands. But our families in New Zealand are weak, therefore, bringing such will actually cause more damage, not less.
You already answered my next question, which was basically, you know, hey Elliot, you know, we just want to smoke some weed here and have a good time. And we're all responsible adults. Why can't we do this?
Right.
And all right, shouldn't people be taking responsibility for themselves? Yeah, I very much respect your argument there that we are in a situation in New Zealand where people are not being responsible because of what I would say has been actually government involvement in breaking down the families.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
It's not so much that the government is going to be protecting you from weed, it's that the government has actually put you in danger of it to begin with.
Yep, that's absolutely right.
For a lot of these vulnerable people.
I have to say I disagree with a lot of what Elliot said, but I disagree with a lot of it as well. I do agree that it is a political ploy. It is no coincidence that they just so happen to be putting it out right next to, oh, do you want
to
vote?
There's nothing else that you get to vote on. You get an election, you get to vote for your next politicians, and at the same time you get to vote for if you want to smoke weed or not. And it's, what a coincidence.
Very, very, very coincidental, and it's probably just going to siphon votes out of the Greens and into Labour because they're going to be viewed as the ones who brought forth this this libertarian view of drugs. And I do agree that that's the political angle here, but I disagree that it's going to cause more harm necessarily. It's going to make it more accessible, of course, but it's going to make it more accessible in a sterile environment. So you're taking an illicit substance out of the hands of the gangs, so you're taking hundreds of millions of dollars worth of revenue out of the hands of the gangs, which is always a good thing. And you're also taking these kids away from their dodgy gang mates who they're buying these drugs from. And
and these gangs are actually trying to sell meth as well. That's their main thing. They're drawing you in for meth.
The gangs aren't making all that much money from selling you a $20 tinny. They're making the money by getting you in the door and then making you leave with a $100 dot. You know, they'd rather sell you meth any day of the week than weed. Weed is the gateway drug because the gangs have it. If the gangs didn't have the entire market on illicit drugs, they wouldn't be able to use weed as a gateway drug because the dispensaries, the illegal weed stores, they will not be trying to sell you crack or meth or heroin or anything because that would just jeopardize their legitimate business. And it is a legitimate business.
Well, actually, that's an interesting note. I would also say that a couple of days ago on Talkback, there was a group of people who were saying that in certain smaller rural provinces where the gangs actually hold strongly on the drug trade there, they have stopped and they've prevented weed being sold. And now only you can buy meth, peep. And so what you're looking at, again, is what is it that you're getting out of weed? It's not so much of a fun time. It's a numbing aspect. You feel euphoric.
Yeah, it's escapism.
It's escapism. Now, in the at-risk communities, that will actually grow further. So when we look at if we're going to buy weed from the dairy, then it doesn't matter where it's bought from, you are going to move on into higher areas to try to push that serotonin level higher in order to gain more escapism. So that's why I guess I say that the damage will be more. The libertarian aspect of it is quite interesting because I think a libertarian argument could be made if the healthcare system was actually user pays or the emergency services was user pays. I think that would be in a way not okay for me anyway, but it would be more acceptable.
Yeah. You know, you say it's legally right to do it, but morally wrong.
That's a huge sticking point for me as well, actually. When people do bring up, you know, well, what about the amount of people who are going to be seeking medical services and making ACC or whatever pay for your overdose and whatnot. And the same thing happening with alcohol, the same thing happening with anything. I honestly take a pretty hardline stance, and I think anybody who suffers from a medical ailment because of alcohol abuse, drug abuse, whatever, they should be, if not treated at all, they should at least have a far lower priority because they've
yeah. As a result, have to pay for something or go into some kind of forced rehabilitation or something where they're
at least be given responsible be, for their... be made to pay their medical fees exactly. back. I mean, I agree,
and I've had a libertarian say this to me. He said, I would be all for legalizing all drugs or whatever, but as long as I have to pay for what happens after you put stuff into your body, I'd like to be able to control what you put into your body. And that's the real problem. In the end, whether it's legal or not, we're still paying for it.
I always cringe when I hear somebody saying that it's, you know, that we should use the government to make somebody do or not do something. So for me, it is pretty important to remain consistent, whether or not, touching on the point of we have weak families and therefore we need to restrict what young people can get into because they don't have a strong father figure or mother figure who's stopping them from getting into these drugs. It's really not the government's place to play that role. They have created the problem because they introduced prohibition. They made it a desirable thing because of prohibition, and prohibition doesn't work.
And they also make dysfunctional families possible via welfare systems, and everything is paid for, from education to healthcare to housing, so people can't truly suffer from their decisions. People can't truly suffer the consequences of their decisions. They can suffer them in their emotional and mental and physical and spiritual well-being, but they can't truly suffer the economic consequences because they will always be paid for.
And undoing anything that has been implemented by the government, such as prohibition, it's always going to have its challenges. I dare say that before marijuana prohibition, everyone wasn't sitting around smoking weed. And if they hadn't implemented prohibition, we probably wouldn't have the same drug problems that we have now. There's been plenty of studies that I've read where the question is posed, does prohibition work? Does a higher drinking age mean less youth drinking? And inevitably, no, it doesn't. It doesn't change the amount of young people who are engaging in these behaviours.
You probably want to respond to that, Elliot, but otherwise, I'll give you a minute to respond, and then I'll switch. I want to follow on from something that.
Good on you. Okay, no worries. So the war on drugs was always a term which I found quite confusing. I never thought it was a war on drugs. I thought it was a way just to protect people from the harms to the community that drugs ensured. So when we talk about the war on drugs, that's. Regardless, it is a legal substance that does harm. I think this goes to the difference between a conservative and a libertarian, where a conservative will look at those who have gone before, those who are currently here, and those who will come, and bringing order in that regard. So I would say that if we do stop this quote-unquote war on drugs, it will just spread out to everywhere. And I know that, again, from many years of being in the field, is that we will actually spread weed all over the place. And when we drop the age of drinking alcohol, what we saw was a lot of 13-14-year-olds drinking, whereas previously when it was 21 we saw a lot of 18-17-year-olds drinking. We brought the age down, and the age went down even further in the illicit area. When we decriminalized prostitution, what we saw was prostitutes became younger, so our child prostitute rate went up and our trafficking actually went up. And they studied by Harvard researchers actually found there was no difference between decriminalization and legalizing, and that worldwide, in these areas that have decriminalized prostitution, we saw more child prostitutes and more prostitution trafficking, to the point where that's quite a negative. So I equate this as an equal type of parallel.
You both brought up the topic of age, and it was something that struck me with this cannabis legalization here, that they're suggesting is a use age of 20. Now, I know that New Conservatives support a drinking age of 20, or is it higher, 20 as well? Now, my personal opinion on this has always been that the age of adulthood should be the age of where everything that is legal should be legal. We should be able to make your own decisions on all things that are legal. Society get it to 18. So your argument is things should be higher for these substances beyond adulthood. And my question here around the use of weed, for instance, is that it's shown to affect your brain the most, especially if you're developing. And no matter how much you use, unlike alcohol, where you can drink a little bit of it and it doesn't really affect your, you know, you've got to be drinking a decent amount of it before it's really affecting your brain negatively. But even then, until about age 25, these things are far more harmful than you than if you're over age 25.
Yep.
Why is the age of 20 being picked? Why not 18 when you're an adult? Or why not 25, which is when it theoretically will not be affecting you as badly anymore? Why 20?
Political pragmatism, I suspect. Uh-huh.
Would you be happier to see it higher? Would you be happier to see it at 25? Or you don't think it's going to make a huge difference? You've made the argument already that a higher age will maybe see people in a different bracket using it.
I don't want to see it. I don't want to see it being brought in. If it was brought in, 25 makes the best sense in terms of causing less damage. I don't think that Labour care, or the Greens care particularly. So they'll go for anything, even if it becomes 18 or 16. But they'll get away with whatever they can get away with.
The higher the age that you put it at, the bigger the market that you have still going and visiting the black market. So if it was 18, you'd have two less years of people going to the black market to procure marijuana. If you put it at 25, you've got 7 more years of people going to the black market before they can legally buy it. So if you put it at 25, you're still going to have 24-year-olds visiting the local tinny shop.
I would also say I think they care, but in the wrong way. I think they'll just go for whatever age they can get where they'll get the most voters.
That's probably right.
It's likely the perception of age 20 is different to a perception of age 18. And yet, my argument here is that's right.
Exactly.
You're always tricked by the $1.99. And my personal view on this always has been if someone is an adult, we should pin things at the age of adulthood. Either way, this feels slightly less bizarre than the case that they have in America, which is where they do have a high drinking age, yet you can join the army at age 16 or age 18, you can vote, you can do everything, but you can't drink alcohol until you're a higher age. And this is a discussion that Elliot and I could have another time, maybe. because I do know you support those higher ages, especially around drinking.
But would you support a higher voting age?
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps 25?
Personally, I would strongly consider it, but I haven't really thought about it.
It's okay. If Elliot says anything wrong, I can cut it out. My personal issue with raising ages on things is that we are raising the age of adulthood as well, and this is something that is going to be completely off topic and maybe for another day, is that we are shifting up the age at which people grow up. Mm. And people don't grow up anymore. Yes. Now you're like, they're talking about tween ages, you've still got man children at age 29, and I just think that is really unhealthy for society. So I don't want to. I've tried to have this discussion around ages to see if we'd have anything interesting to say, but I actually do think generally you don't want to be pushing up the age of adulthood and the age where people grow up and trying to baby people until they're in very high ages. I do not believe that's a healthy thing for a society.
You're shifting the acceptable age of responsibility.
Mm. Exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
I think we've had enough about weed today. I'd like to move this into a related question around a new Conservative Party policy on binding referendums. Mm-hmm. So to talk less about the specifics of this referendum, but the idea of the referendum itself, which is that the new Conservative Party supports binding referendums.
Yes.
And if this referendum goes through at the election, then essentially would you support the legislation if it has the support of the people?
Yes.
Do you have any thresholds around that? I'm trying to remember your policy. Or is it if it gets 51% or an insufficient
turnout? Right, I see. So in terms of a citizens-initiated binding referendum, the way we have it is that if you get signatures on a piece of paper, that is 5% of the voting population from the previous election, then you can kick off a referendum. And in that, if you've got two-thirds, then it passes. Two-thirds,
okay. In a referendum like this, let's say the cannabis referendum is close. It's like, 52-48, which is not that close, but it could even be closer. Do you still believe that a referendum like that should be binding, or would you feel less strongly?
Depends. I mean, it's a government-initiated one, so whatever rules they've come up with, then we follow those rules.
It actually doesn't sound like if you've read the news articles, it doesn't sound like they've actually set any rules around this. It's more like a gentleman's agreement. Or a gentle ladies, gentle person's agreement between
neutral person.
Between Labour and New Zealand First and the Greens, and even National. They're trying to convince National to come on board, but they haven't. So it's actually only three parties that have made this sort of I am going to say gentleman's agreement because we're non-politically correct on this podcast, and whether or not it's intended to be honoured is going to remain to be seen. Right?
The Justice Minister this afternoon on ZB said that is going to be binding, and they will honour... He hands down said that they will honour the outcome.
They're making it binding on themselves, but I do not believe that it will not be legally binding.
He also said... No, I don't think it's legally binding at all, but he said this government is committed to the result of the referendum. However, any successive government can undo it.
Exactly.
Because successive government can undo anything they want. So.
That's right. You're right about that. But the problem is, the successive government would have to pass this legislation. This is where it gets tricky.
Mm.
Let's say the National Party wins the next election.
We're
making up that the National Party wins the next election. The new Conservative Party does exceptionally well, and you're in some kind of coalition government, and the referendum passes. I know I'm asking the what if question, which is really bad.
Ooh, what if,
I don't want to be doing the what if scenario, but what do you see happening in that case?
It's a harder question. It hasn't been a citizens initiated referendum, so we're less likely to engage in it.
So you'll see how it goes, basically.
We would see how it goes. That would definitely be more of a discussion point, if it was citizens initiated, yes, easy question. Yes, we would. We would honour it, even if it's something that we don't agree with, because it's the people's will. But in terms of this beast is something different. It is exploitative by its very nature. It is yet again another example of how Labour like to use identity politics.
But it is still voted upon by the citizens.
It is.
And they've been given plenty of notice... Mm-hmm. As to, I mean, it's not like it's just being sprung upon them.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Like, oh, by the way, we're also going to tack this on to the end of the ballot. It's been discussed multiple times, both when it was first incepted and now, I do believe likely
what will happen is this draft, if the referendum passes, this draft is there, but will likely be passed into law regardless of what happens next election. Yeah. It's likely, because if that's what they put on the ballot. But the national government is very notorious for ignoring referendums, so we will have to wait and see. We really will have to wait and see.
Yes.
And this is by no means cut and dried. This is going to be quite a volatile situation.
Mm.
You've already answered sort of my other question around New Conservatives sets itself up as a principled party. You're opposed to the legalization of drugs. You're pro-life. You're opposed to euthanasia being introduced. You're opposed to abortion reform. But how does that gel with your citizens-initiated referendums? You will stick with the will of the people in a citizens-initiated referendum on any issue at all.
Yep.
And so that is one of your principles as well.
Yes.
And we will see if those ever come into clash. Mm. Yeah, you hope not.
We hope not, but it will.
One of the other issues that you yourself have been very vocal on has been the issue around the Department of Education, some of their programs around the queer LGBT agenda and various other issues in terms of education, perhaps the current education reforms that have been promoted as well. How do you envision, how do you clear out the entrenched Marxist agenda in the education ministries and so on? If you were to initiate some real change there, what is the process by which you would go about?
Do we line them up and blindfold them?
No. I mean, that was a joke, guys. That was
100% a joke. Please don't.
Yeah. We're going to... Yeah. Elliot's in trouble.
Report.
I'm going to leave that joke in as well.
Yeah. So I think one thing which we do absolutely agree with ACT and really appreciate what ACT brought in was the charter schools policy. Love charter school policies. I worked for the very first charter school that existed, and I saw it firsthand how it actually really helped, especially those of our at-risk students, our Māori and Pasifika students as well. It was just an excellent, excellent thing and way to do things.
How does a charter school, just briefly, differ from your public school or private school?
So the big way that a charter school differs is where a state school has basically a funneling of money going through it, and they have money for certain ways of doing things and no money for other ways. A charter school is given a lump sum of money, and they're given a bunch of outcomes that they have to achieve. If they manage to get those achievements, great, no problem. Any little bit of money they get to keep. If they run out of money or they've got to go over budget, they've got to take that hit and they've got to go with it. But what that did, which is one of the great examples of free market ideas, is that meant that schools had to engage in creative thinking and relationship building and competitive ideas. So you had Vanguard, for example, had approximately 30 cents on the dollar of a state school setup, similar setup. For every dollar that a state school similar setup would have, Vanguard had around about 30 cents or a third of what a state school would get. They were able to get their help subsidize young people's trips from South Auckland all the way over to Vanguard, which is over in Albany. They were able to hire out halls or purchase buildings and do what they wanted to do. Effectively, it's creative. You can choose to do what you want to do with your money as long as you come out with the outcomes on the other side. A normal school won't be able to do that. They've only got a certain amount of money to do here, and that's also where they come in and they try to get parents to give them funding and those elements.
Would you support expanding the charter school model to, say, all schools? Do you believe it's actually a much better school system?
I absolutely would, and I think it works real well over in one of the Scandinavian countries as well.
And are you familiar with the sort of the voucher system that ACT has proposed? Is that similar, or would you prefer that?
I haven't looked at all of the angles, but my understanding is that they've pretty much done a carbon copy of what has happened over in the couple of the Scandinavian nations. If it is so, then I like it. I like it.
That's good. Yeah, I'm personally more into private schools. I went to a small Christian private school, and again, that school functions with a fraction of the kind of money that state schools get. And in the case of a private school, it's all purely paid for by the parents. And the same thing, the results always were outstanding compared to any comparable public school. The charter school model, as you've described it, is the complete opposite of what the Labour Party has proposed in their education reforms, which is to essentially eliminate school boards, to eliminate local control and local responsibilities for these schools, and to centralise everything.
It just sounds terrifying.
It is like the absolute Marxist, like, it's just straight up the communist,
utopia
where every single school in the country is essentially run from the bureaucrat's office.
It works so well because every single child is exactly the same.
And you can tell, you know that is going to be disastrous, right? It'll have disastrous results, academic achievement will collapse, you will see huge, huge systematic failures throughout all of New Zealand society if they implement this plan. But they don't really care. Anybody can see it coming from a mile away. I find it hard to believe that they don't see it coming. How could you be that ideologically scoped in to think that this is a good idea? Just blows my mind.
National undo it? No.
No, they won't. Good joke. That was the real joke.
Labour implements a whole lot of government power and National says, thank you, I'll take it.
In all likelihood, what they will do is they will pass, because this is what they did with the last school, and they will pass some kind of national standards. Like, they'll reintroduce some level of national standards. And then Labour will come along and remove it. So they'll, like, make it slightly better, and then it'll get a whole lot worse. And make it slightly better, and then it'll get a whole lot worse. And it just goes round in a circle. Because the education system is just being driven into the ground by successive
governments. The problem is, there's an education system.
Yeah, that's right. It needs to go. I'm not a big fan of government education, as you can tell. All right, well, I like your ideas around that, and it sounds like one of the ideal systems that you think has actually sort of been very partially implemented by the ACT Party. As you can see, it wasn't good enough because of how easy it is to dismantle by the Labour government. And so my recommendation here to all those who would like to reform the schooling system, go to a private school instead.
and ignore the teachers' union.
Teachers' unions are the real problem. But if you can't do that, or for whatever reason you don't want to do that, you need some kind of huge systematic change where things are removed so far from the government's control, especially the further you push things locally, the further you decentralize things, the harder it is for them to gather that back up. So you want to fling it far and wide, and that was a real problem with the existing charter schools model, is it was too easy. I don't even think they had to pass any legislation. I believe it was just some little tweak but with a cabinet paper, and they more or less made charter schools irrelevant. So it was not entrenched enough. And that's the hard part, is entrenching these ideas, entrenching your policies so that the next government can't just come in and sweep it away with a broom. And that's where I believe really pushing for decentralization and really pushing for people to take control of their local institutions and taking responsibility and working in their communities for local solutions is actually far, far better, and that helps to remove that power from Wellington, because that's where all of the greedy, power hungry people will go. They want to go where the power is, and they want to amass more power for power's sake. I think we've got a little bit of time for some of my looser questions for you, more fun, my harder questions.
Oh, here we go.
For Elliot to answer. We've discussed free speech a few times on this podcast. The continuing Israel Folau saga is still in the news. We haven't had any updates on Andrew Little's review of free speech legislation. We sort of do see the continued fallout of the chief censor banning the Christchurch Killer's manifesto and his video. We see the media creating a pact to limit the way they're going to be reporting his trial. how does this fit in with what you envision the role of the government actually is in terms of what can and should be limited? Because when I first read New Conservatives' policy on having an internet filter and saying, oh no, you've got to be over 18 to access certain stuff on the internet, I thought, oh no, we shouldn't be giving the government that power. And then in the last couple of months, I'm like, what kind of crazy power does the government have when they can just wipe websites off the internet? They can say, hey ISPs, would you like to take this down? And it's gone. They can say, no, you can't read this. I mean, I already did know in a sense they had the power to ban books, but you don't think that it's that broad that they can actually apply it to all kinds of situations. Mm. Do you believe the government should have the power it currently does in terms to actually outright ban things? Or would you rather, is your system of a sort of just a level of restriction that you have to request access to better? Or do you the see second, them both?
Yeah, so the latter. So when it comes to that particular point with ISPs, it's actually about pornography. Mm-hmm. And I've worked with a lot of kids who have been sneakily going on to the porn. And when I've had parents in my office, the first thing I do is I look at the young person when they're saying, oh, you know, he's waking up real tired, I don't know what the problem is. And then he says, oh, I've got my phone on and I'm listening to music. And I always have a good look at the boy usually, and I say, are you watching porn? And usually, or almost always, breakdown cries, and then I have a look at what they've been looking at. And some of what they're looking at, it's not the boy has sex with girl sort of thing. We're talking depravity, we're talking simulated rape scenes, all of that. So anyway, the depravity is there.
The most absolutely horrific stuff you can think of is that obviously anything is accessible on the internet.
Yes.
And these parents who should be protecting these children are not actually doing
that. Yeah, the parents who should be, most of them are clueless. And it comes back, it's even, for example, when I talk about Grand Theft Auto to parents. But besides that, by having a opt-in account with your ISP means that it's not going to be a child who's able to do that. It means that the adult is then, or whoever's paying the bill, is then taking upon their own shoulders to allow for that pornography to come through if they so desire. So after that, then it's on their head be it. But at the moment, so many of the, especially the children, the 11, 12 year olds who I've dealt with, their pornography is being done with the ignorance of parents as opposed to the willful choice of the parent to have that pornography accessible through their internet. So again, this goes back to our Edmund Burke type of conservatism. We look at how to protect the community, we look at those past, present, and in the future, and that's what we're doing with that one. In terms of the free speech overall, we find all the aspects around what Andrew Little is doing to be utterly disgraceful, but also in line with exactly how he has been occurring. So last year, for the last couple of years, Gil Reese has been going on and on about changing free speech and that we need to be changing the laws and regulating. Andrew Little has gone to the UN. Last year, he was pushing also for free speech to change. The Christchurch massacre has given him the perfect opportunity to change those rules. And last Friday, I was at the Hamilton Press Club, where there were very big personalities in the media. I Tangata was there, Stuff was there, a whole bunch of people there. Gil Reese was there as well. One thing that chilled me to the bone was that so many of them, including Moana Jackson, were getting up and saying that freedom of speech is fine, but not if someone else feels that they have been harmed by your freedom of speech.
There's always that but, isn't but. There? It's like, I'm all for free speech, but it's like, all right, stop talking right now.
But what chilled me was that the people in the room that I was in are powerful people.
Yeah.
Very powerful people. And that they have all share this theme of freedom of speech, but not really, is incredibly concerning to us as normal Kiwis going day to by day. And I think we're going to see some scary stuff coming if we don't get up and actually do something about it.
All right, very good. Thank you for answering that question. It's probably just about time to wrap up. I'm going to finish with one final question for you. Ooh. Is I've seen some pictures. I've seen some pictures of you with Don Brash, yes. So your secret meetings with Don Brash have been revealed here. I am just genuinely curious. Is your focus here on what Hobson's Pledge is doing around one law for all, removing race references and preferences from legislation, or are you more looking at even an economic side of things? Like, are you just friends? You're just having a chat with a friend. Is he giving you some advice? Is he somehow involved a little bit in?
Actually, he's a mate. We first met in South Auckland a couple of years ago, and we And ever since then, I've sort of just kept tabs, and he's kept tabs on me. And it didn't come until the free speech debate that occurred when I was called up the day before by Don saying, oh, look, there's this debate going on. Do you mind coming in and giving us a hand? So I jumped in there. We had the debate, and ever since then I realised, oh, this guy's actually not racist.
Look at that. The media hasn't been telling you the truth the whole time.
Yeah. I even went to Waitangi with him, and I was very proud to tautoko him going to Waitangi. And it was quite fascinating because there was me, Te Hawa, and also Casey Costello. Three Māori were walking around with him. And it was quite fascinating that even in that Waitangi, the media were saying, ah, you know, this guy's a racist. Where in actual fact, Don was getting good kudos from the local, the mana whenua in the area, because of the fact that he came to share his knowledge with the Ngāpuhi people if they wished to improve their economic power. He's an awesome guy, genuine, he is a good man. I'm really honoured to know him.
Thank you very much. That's nice. Thanks for sharing that.
Nice and wholesome.
That's good. It's good. I'm glad to know. It's good. It's good to see that you're getting along and that I think Don Brash has sort of seen a bit of a resurgence of his popularity in recent times. Mm. I think, and he's found his niche. He's really found somewhere where he feels at home. And no matter how much the media and these various hate groups try to sort of slander him, he is actually doing some good work behind the scenes. Yep. You know, not so much out in the open, but it sounds like he most definitely is very active and being useful behind the scenes. All right, thank you everyone. That's all for this week. As always, I would like to close with a piece of classical music, and I'm going to ask our guest what he has selected for us.
So I've selected Adagio for Strings, and the reason being is I don't look at music as big story of the conductor and all the music piece, rather the emotions that it emanates from one when they listen to such. This is a piece that I've heard for many years, and you'll recognize it too, I'm sure. And it is one which is one of the big drivers of myself, which is pain and love. And I've always thought that I want to defeat pain somehow. And you'll see that theme comes through anyway in this particular music.
Yes, it's a very emotional theme used in some war movies. And it's composed by Samuel Barber. And it was composed in 1935. So it's actually quite a recent piece. Classical music is still being made today. It's not just old stuff. Bits of our culture are still being made in recent times and even to this day. All right, I will close with just a minute or two of that, all I can get away with. And please do follow us on the various social medias. Just give us your feedback. We do read it all. And thank you very much for your support.
Bye.
Ka kite.